From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is VOA Senior National Correspondent Jim Malone. Our guest on this edition of the program is Daryl West, Vice President and Director of Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution, a prominent think tank here in Washington. He's also the founding director of the Center for Technology Innovation at Brookings. A well-established author and political scientist, West has written extensively about technology, policy, mass media and campaigns, and elections in the United States. He's the author or co-author of 24 books, and they have won 4 book awards and been translated into Chinese, Japanese, and Korean. Prior to joining Brookings, Daryl West was a professor of political science and public policy at Brown University in the northeastern state of Rhode Island. His most recent book is entitled Divided Politics, Divided Nation: Hyper-Conflict in the Trump Era, and it was published in 2019. In the aftermath of the horrific mass shootings in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio, we'll ask Daryl West about what he thinks are the main factors fueling the increasing polarization in the United States, divisions that manifest themselves in disagreements over immigration and gun safety legislation, for example, and what can be done to address it. And Daryl West joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Carol. It's nice to be with you.
And as always, I'm delighted to welcome my colleague, VOA National Correspondent Jim Malone.
Thanks, Carol.
Well, first, Daryl West, as a political scientist and an expert on polarization in America, what's your reaction to the horrific mass shootings in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio? What factors do you think are contributing to this polarization in our country, this divide between Republicans and Democrats, and the amplification of voices of hate, particularly white supremacists, who we know have existed in this country for decades, but whose voices seem to have been bolstered in recent years?
Well, the shootings were very tragic, but they hit pretty close to home for me because I grew up about 30 miles outside of Dayton, so I know the area well. I still have relatives who live there and friends who live there. So when I heard the news first about El Paso and then shortly thereafter the shootings in Dayton, it was very difficult to hear the news. But this is just the most recent shooting of many. You know, it seems like every few weeks we have another one of these. And I remember a couple years ago when there were the shootings in Parkland, Florida. My brother lives in Florida. He was very upset about the shootings, went on Facebook, called for the need for gun control, said it was time for action. And one of my high school friends responded by saying, and he still lives in the hometown where I grew up, which is a conservative part of Ohio, and he told his friends, keep your guns because someday we're going to need them. And I think that illustrates the divide in America. There are many people, especially people who live in cities on the East Coast and the West Coast, who want gun control and think gun violence is completely out of control. There are other people who live in rural areas in the heartland, the middle part of the United States, who basically think that we need even more guns, and guns are a means of self-defense.
Exactly. Just let me repeat my question, though, with respect to what factors do you think are really contributing to these divisions in our country? What would you say are some of the main factors?
I think the main factor in this particular area is just the urban-rural divide that exists in America. People have very different cultural values, religious values, and certainly attitudes towards guns. I remember when I was growing up, I had lots of friends and family members who like to fish, like to hunt. We had guns when I was growing up. It was not uncommon at all. And people there believe that the Second Amendment protects the right to bear arms and that Americans should have the right to do that. People who live in cities see all the gun violence and just think things are completely out of control. We have these military-style weapons that people can easily purchase, even if one has a mental health problem. And so it's hard for the two sides of America to come together, even for common sense reforms that, according to public opinion polls, many Americans support stronger background checks. Many people at this point would favor a ban on military-style weapons, but we are not able to get Congress to actually take action in this area.
Quick question before I turn to Jim. The other issue on which there are
extreme divisions in this country is immigration. Now, the alleged shooter in El Paso was a man who actually mimicked some of the denigrating language uttered by U.S. President Donald Trump regarding Hispanic immigrants and residents in El Paso. And while he is certainly not the cause, obviously, Mr. Trump, of these massacres, to what extent do you think Mr. Trump's disparaging rhetoric regarding immigrants, minorities, democratically controlled urban areas like Baltimore, his vilification of four Democratic female minority members of Congress, to what extent does all of this contribute, in your view, to a mood which elevates rather than actually marginalizes the voices of hate and intolerance?
I think all of those appeals on the part of the president make the environment worse and encourage people who share those views to go out and act on them. Trump, of course, has been very vocal in opposing many different types of immigration. And of course, you know, building the wall was a big part of his 2016 presidential campaign. And so when he talks the way he does at rallies and insults minority members of Congress and says very divisive things on race, people in the hinterland who have guns and share those values and they don't like immigrants do exactly what that El Paso person did, which was to go to a place where he knew was a big Hispanic community, and he started to shoot a lot of people, and that was his goal.
Jim?
You know, one thing I wanted to ask you about, since particularly the rise of the Tea Party early in the Obama administration, there seems to be a strain of thought there that compromise was a bad thing, that what really mattered was standing up for your beliefs no matter what. And we can point to examples, I guess, on both sides of the political spectrum. But it just makes you think, you know, how did we get to the point where the country is so dug in its own sort of narratives, competing narratives, and there just seems to be so little appetite for efforts to try to meet in the middle?
Well, I remember when Obama won the 2008 election, there were people who said America was moving into a post-racial society and that race would not matter very much anymore. That clearly was completely wrong. Democrats had big majorities in both the House and the Senate. So in the first 2 years, they passed Obamacare. They did a major fiscal stimulus plan to get the country out of the Great Recession. So it was a time of very substantial policymaking. But as you point out, within 2 years, we saw the protest movement known as the Tea Party emerge. I had family members who were Tea Party advocates and would attend Tea Party rallies, so I would talk with them about it. And they were opposed to what Obama was doing. They just saw him as a big government liberal and raising taxes and kind of moving the country in a direction that they personally did not like. So I think you're right that the Tea Party was a major turning point in helping to crystallize the differences, again, between cities and the rural areas, between liberals and conservatives, and between Republicans and Democrats.
And we used to have, going back 50 years, you can see the sharp political differences on display in the Congress over various issues. There did seem to be a period, though, back then where lawmakers might be more friendly toward one another, even though they were of different parties. But especially since the election of 2016, there seems to be more of an on display this effort to demonize the other side. It seems like we're heading down a road, and goodness, I mean, these recent violent incidents, you know, can be a byproduct of that. It's kind of very demoralizing for the country as a whole.
Today, people view opponents as enemies, and I think that's an important distinction because, you know, over the last 50 years, Congress has become much more polarized. I mean, when I was growing up, there were moderate Republicans and conservative Democrats. And so there were a number of members of Congress who would characterize themselves as moderate, would vote with members of the other party. And over the last 50 years, those moderates, one by one, have dropped out, retired, or been defeated in primaries. So we've reached the point where we basically have conservative Republicans and liberal Democrats with very little in between. And it really contributes to that atmosphere of seeing opponents as enemies and viewing compromise as a dirty word. And it basically has made it very difficult to address the problems that we have. America and the rest of the world face big problems, but our governing ability is quite limited. It's very hard to overcome that polarization and get members of Congress to agree on things that even two-thirds of the general public would support.
Darrell West, back to Mr. Trump and the rhetoric he uses. Some analysts say President Trump is like an arsonist. You know, he ignites a problem, but he then pretends to be the fireman to put out the fires. As an expert on mass communication, presidential rhetoric, can you help us understand what is going on, the contradictions? You know, he speaks words from a teleprompter denouncing white supremacy, bigotry, and racism in the aftermath of these massacres, saying that these are sinister ideologies, that they have to be defeated. But we know that in the past, in his rallies, you know, he has vilified immigrants, saying Mexicans are rapists or criminals. He says they're invading our country. These are sort of words that have been echoed by the shooter in El Paso. So once again, we see these contradictions. And then even before he went to El Paso and Dayton, in remarks to reporters, he actually doubled down on his anti-immigration sentiment, which is rather insensitive, one could say. And it illustrates the fact that he just can't seem to separate this immigration issue from the epidemic of gun violence and hatred.
With Trump, it's all about playing to the base. I mean, that's how he won in 2016. And some people hoped he might moderate a little bit when he became president, and that just hasn't happened. I mean, he still is playing to the base on every issue, certainly on race, on immigration, on tax policy, on the size of government, on many other issues. He has concluded in a highly polarized electorate, he knows that half of the country is against him. They're Democrats, they're liberals, they're suburban moms, and they're never going to support what he does. And so he has concluded what he needs to do is to really go the conservative route and the ultra-nationalist route. And his view is that he wants to get a big turnout from the white community as well as people who share traditional cultural values, and he thinks that is going to be sufficient to reelect him in 2020.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Darrell West. He's author, political scientist, and vice president and director of governance studies at the Brookings Institution. That's a think tank based here in Washington. I'm Carol Castiel, along with VOA senior national correspondent Jim Malone. And this is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Well, here's a big shout out to a loyal listener, Monawar Ahmed Wahidi from Kandahar, Afghanistan. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to PCUSA@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. And now back to our special guest, Darrell West, and let me now turn to my colleague Jim Malone for a question.
You know, a lot of what we've talked about are political divisions in the country and the polarization that's been developing for decades. I wonder, though, as you know, you've written books about the country and talked to Americans all across the spectrum and in different areas of the country, what have you found the sort of common threads that bring Americans together? We're sort of shredded on a lot of these political issues and divisiveness, but I assume there are other areas where Americans are much more unified than it may appear otherwise.
I think people are unified on some issues, and certainly the divisive issues get more attention and they're more obvious, especially under the current administration. But people are still united on a lot of bread and butter issues. I grew up in a working class community in rural Ohio, and Americans, when I was growing up, very much believed in the American dream. I personally had a lot of opportunity. Getting a college education was relatively inexpensive for me. Buying the first home wasn't terribly expensive. But when I look at today's kids, they're having difficulty paying for college, getting health care, buying the first home, just kind of getting established. You know, there have been structural changes in the economy. So I think there are people who are coming together recognizing that something fundamental has changed in the United States and in a negative direction, and there has been a loss of economic opportunity. So people are I think, very much in agreement on that. But the problem is they have different villains on what the cause of that problem is. So conservatives say big government, it's too big, too expensive, taxes are too high, there are too many regulations, and that's what's destroying economic opportunity. Liberals basically point to big business, wealthy, income inequality, and say those are the things that have destroyed economic prosperity. And so the two sides then have very different remedies. So I think people are united on seeing the problem, but then they have different explanations of what the problem is and what we need to do to get out of it.
And, you know, we look at these election maps that, you know, even around the world, people can see them from recent elections, red representing Republican areas and blue Democrats. And you can see the Democratic areas clustered around the big cities, generally around the coasts, and this huge swath of red generally in the middle of the country. But it sort of reflects this urban rural divide. And you do wonder where that's headed. There's a lot of attention being paid to try to regenerate interest in rural areas. But it's a really uphill struggle, especially with the industrial shift from the heartland overseas. So this is something I guess we're going to be dealing with for a long time to come.
These geographic disparities are a big part of our problem today, both in terms of the loss of economic opportunity and then the political polarization that has emerged. I have some colleagues in our Brookings Metro program that did an analysis. They found that right now, 15% of American counties generate 64% of the GDP. And what that means in practical terms is almost all the economic activity is on the East Coast, the West Coast, and then a few metropolitan areas in between. Like, vast parts of America are simply being left behind. There are no jobs, there's no economic opportunity, and there's no future, and people are upset about that. We may shortly be in a situation where the prosperous parts of America have 30 senators, basically representing 15 states, and the not very prosperous parts have 70 senators. And if that is our future, that's a recipe for Trumpism on steroids, that Trumpism may actually outlast Trump just because of the economic differences and the geographic disparities.
And Darrell West, you make a case for political moderation. Do you think moderation is attainable when political actors, like the president, often demonstrate a casual relationship with the truth? That is, President Trump has been documented as having said falsehoods on thousands of occasions.
Most Americans are not liberal or conservative. They're still in the middle, and they can swing one way or the other depending on the choices. But I think there's going to be a major test of this within the Democratic Party, of the candidates like Joe Biden, who's basically running much more as a centrist and saying, look, what's wrong with America is Donald Trump. And if we get rid of Trump, we can actually make progress on a lot of issues. We can build on Obama's legacy and we can move forward. There are other Democrats from the progressive wing who agree that Trump is a big problem, but they say getting rid of him does not solve the issue of income inequality, climate change, the geographic disparities, race relations, and a host of other problems, and that therefore, because of the magnitude of those problems, we need much bigger solutions. And just building on what Obama did is not going to be sufficient. We need much more substantial political change, like Mayor Pete, for example, has said we need to get rid of the Electoral College. Others have proposed major policy changes.
Right. Mayor Pete Buttigieg, the Democratic candidate from
South Bend,
Indiana, right? He's a mayor. Well, speaking of the Electoral College, to what extent do you think that exacerbates the divide in this country? You know, we're one of the few countries, I think, in the world that elects its president through the Electoral College, this rather arcane system of electors, as opposed to the national popular vote. There is a trend, not just Pete Buttigieg, but others, other Democrats in particular, are advocating that we abolish the Electoral College. What do you say?
I would agree with that. I think it is time for the Electoral College to go, and we should move to direct popular election, which actually is the way most countries choose their chief executives these days. But I think at this particular moment, the Electoral College is dangerous because twice in the last 16 years, we've had a discrepancy between the popular vote and the Electoral College. Al Gore won the popular vote in 2000. Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by more than 3 million votes in 2016, but lost the Electoral College. With the geographic disparities that we were just talking about, And the fact that every state has two senators, which then kind of overrepresents small states in the Electoral College, this may be our future. We may end up in a situation where in many presidential elections, the person who wins the popular vote does not win the Electoral College. If that starts happening all the time, that will provoke a constitutional crisis in the United States.
You know, one of the issues, you mentioned this a little bit earlier, this sort of President Trump sort of nationalist view, this sort of philosophy of America first. To what extent was he a provocateur of this idea, but also to what extent was the groundwork already laid, and especially in some of these rural communities or the former industrial heartland where people were ready to look for something, and it was more that Trump came along rather than led the parade on this particular theme?
Trump did not start political polarization. It was very much there well before him, although he has played to it in many respects, made it worse and kind of contributed to the political divisions. But in my most recent book, Divided Politics, it's a 40-year political history of the United States looking from 1980 up to the current period, or basically the period from Ronald Reagan up through Donald Trump. And with each presidency, you can see how the country started to become more divided. I mean, at the time, I thought Reagan was a divisive president, but yet he raised taxes in order to balance the budget. He did immigration reform that included a path to citizenship for people who were here in an undocumented capacity. So it's not clear with that type of policy view, Ronald Reagan could win a Republican nomination today. Like, that's how much the country has changed. And then as we went from Clinton to Bush to Obama and now to Trump, the intensity of the opposition strengthened, the polarization deepened, and all the political divisions became much more intense.
Well, speaking of Reagan, Darrell West, let's talk about how the Republican Party has transformed itself. It's unrecognizable to many Republicans. In other words, we're seeing the very values that used to underpin the party being upended. It seems no longer to be the party of free trade, or the party that wants to balance the budget, keep the deficit down. We no longer hear talk of promotion of democracy. You know, the understanding of who our enemies and who our friends are has been upended in many ways. We're hearing voices, albeit on the far right, who are even questioning whether or not Russia interfered in the election, basically questioning the findings of 17 U.S. intelligence agencies, in addition to Special Counsel Robert Mueller's report on Russia's interference. Some of these are on the fringe or even doubting whether or not white supremacists are even on the rise or the cause of the majority of hate crimes in this country. These are facts. These aren't political talking points of the left. I mean, these are facts that the FBI has documented. How do you see this, you know, gradual transformation of the Republican Party, particularly since the rise of President Trump?
You're 100% right on all those points. I mean, Trump has been remarkably successful in remaking the Republican Party. Like, for much of my adulthood, the Republican Party was the party of free trade. Like, they wanted to build relations with other countries. You know, Nixon was the one who opened up the relationship with China, and many other Republicans helped support that. George W. Bush was a very strong advocate for immigration reform, very much along the confines of what many progressives would support today. But Trump came along, and what he saw was that the agreement that Republicans and Democrats had on trade issues and on immigration issues were starting to not be shared by certain parts of the American public. He played to those people and won the presidency. And then over the last 2 years, has really managed to impose his views on the party.
It's one thing for Mr. Trump to adhere to some of these beliefs, which are rather puzzling, you know, tariffs as opposed to negotiating free trade and being a proponent of free trade, running up the deficit. But it's another thing to see the Republican Party, the party of Ronald Reagan, of more recently Richard Lugar or Chuck Hagel or John McCain, to see that these politicians have actually tacitly accepted. This is what I think many Americans find disturbing.
Well, the most important thing to know about the Republican Party is Trump has a more than 80% job approval rating among Republicans. And so even though there are many Republicans in Congress who basically disagree with Trump's stance on trade, immigration, race relations, and so on, they toe the line and they keep voting to support his positions because they know with his high approval rating among Republicans, if they oppose him, they are going to get a primary and they're probably going to lose that primary. And we've seen several examples. Jeff Flake, who is a senator from Arizona, who came out and criticized Trump, and his own job approval rating dropped, and it reached a point where he just knew he could not seek re-election, that he would not win. Others see that happening. They know if they oppose him within the party, the same thing is going to happen to them. And so they simply keep quiet with their opposition and support whatever he wants.
Let's talk about the role of the news media and social media in amplifying extreme voices, particularly on the far right, Daryl West. Social media was once a force of good. It helped to foster the Arab Spring, the demonstrations for greater political freedom in places like Tunisia and Egypt. But now we're seeing the same platform being used for nefarious purposes. What can you tell us about the force and the influence, for example, of never mind Facebook or Twitter, but, for example, these dark web platforms like 4chan and 8chan as vehicles for the spread of extremism and hatred, which can lead to violence, and we have seen that.
Digital technology and social media are a big part of America's growing extremism because they provide a means for individuals with views outside the mainstream to find other people who feel exactly the same way, and then they reinforce each other's views, and then some of them actually start to act on it and engage in violent activities.
What about these dark websites, 4chan, 8chan, that are being used by extremists to spew their hatred? Do you think they should be shut down? Can these platforms be monitored by the FBI? And should they be?
I mean, digital platforms that allow people to encourage others to engage in violence should be shut down. Even under America's pretty broad interpretation of freedom of speech, like, we don't allow people to go out on a sidewalk and say, you should kill somebody else. That is not acceptable. And so we should impose the same standard on the digital world. We've kind of let digital technology develop however it wanted with very few rules or very few regulations. We need to start moving the sensible rules and regulations that we already have in the non-digital world towards these digital platforms and close down the ones that are clearly crossing the lines into inciting violence or promoting hatred. There is a problem in the sense that, you know, you can close down a site in one place and they're just going to find some other spot and then use social media to alert people to where the new location is. So it is a little bit like whack-a-mole that you kind of close down one site and then, you know, three others pop up.
Any closing remarks, Daryl West, with respect to how we can bridge this divide in this country as we approach the 2020 elections?
Well, in the closing chapter of my Divided Politics book, I actually end on an optimistic note by saying, if we want to address polarization and try and bring the country together, we have to address the root causes, which in my view are the loss of economic opportunity, the geographic disparities, like that is what's fueling the divide, people feeling left behind, and then they're looking for scapegoats of people to blame for the fact that they're not doing well. Like, if we don't deal with income inequality and the loss of economic opportunity, hatred and animosity are going to continue to spread. We're also going to need political reforms. Like, right now, our system of governance is not functioning very effectively, and so we're going to need institutional reforms and election reforms to address those problems. And then the very last idea I suggest is, I call it, take a liberal or conservative to lunch, which is if you're liberal, find a conservative and vice versa. We can't just expect polarization to be solved top down from the government. This is like a culture problem. All of us have a responsibility one-on-one to reach out to other people, have the conversation, try and understand the views of people who have opinions different from oneself.
Daryl West is the Vice President and Director of Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution. His most recent book is Divided Politics, Divided Nation, Hyper-Conflict in the Trump Era. Daryl West, thank you so much for coming in, sharing your unique insights and analysis of the political climate here in America.
Thank you, Carol.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Jessica Von Zastro for booking our guest. Our engineer was Bill Andrade. Joining me on the program was VOA Senior National Correspondent Jim Malone. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.